Blog Talk Radio.
Guest. Our guest is Julie Fisher, and she's written a book called Importing Democracy, The Role of NGOs, that's non-government organizations, in South Africa, Tajikistan, and Argentina. It's a study steeped in history and culture and syllabus details about the efforts of local and national democratization NGOs in South Africa, Tajikistan, and Argentina. So we're going to talk to her at half the hour. In the meantime, we have plenty of news and views, our views, and some news. Lots of stuff going on, Leo.
Yeah, keep going. I'm trying to touch
okay. There was something I wanted to read here. Over 800 world scientists agree GM crops are nothing short of a bio war in our food. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand why genetically modified foods are dangerous. But if you look closely, you may just find the name of one listed among the names of more than 800 scientists from around the globe who have joined forces in an open letter to all world governments outlining their detailed concerns over the alarming potential threat of biotech's unauthorized worldwide GM food experiment. That's 800 scientists. That's great. It's called. It's from Wake Up Call. That's the site that has this.
Yep.
I'm talking about biofood. In a country whose government and media appear only too eager to conjure up the fear of bioterrorism and biological weapons, it's shocking to what extent the GMO issue remains omitted from the mainstream discussion. Consider that the message from these scientists seems to be that the whole planet is already under attack by the persistent and largely unchecked reckless behavior of greedy, unruly U.S. corporations. Corporations whose activities appear to be sponsored by the federal government. And whether you know it yet or not, your body is the battleground. The letter, as posted by the Institute of Science and Society, is a collective call for the immediate suspension of any and all releases of GM products and crops into the environment for at least 5 years in order to allow for more thorough testing. The scientists further demand that all patents on life forms and living processes, including seeds, cell lines, and genes, be revoked and banned for a comprehensive public inquiry into the future of agriculture and food security for all. Life is a discovery, they say, not an innovation. And patents on life forms and living processes sanction biopiracy of indigenous knowledge and genetic resources, violate basic human rights and dignity, compromise health care, impede medical and scientific research, and are against the welfare of animals. Furthermore, they argue that GMO crops provide no identifiable benefits either to the farmer or consumers. Instead, they offer only significant risks to all living things. GMOs are just bad news, followed by more bad news. Any consumption of GMO products is basically a smorgasbord of disaster, says these global scientists in their thorough and fully cited open letter. They take biotechnology to task, making clear, undeniable connections between between GMO fruit crops and other products like milk from cows injected with genetically modified bovine growth hormone, and health problems for mammals in general. At the same time, the GM crops themselves actually contribute to lower yields, increased use of herbicide, insecticide, unpredictable performance, poor economic returns, and a progressive monopoly on food by big corporations. They also encourage herbicide-tolerant weeds and pesticide-resistant superbugs, making their purported goal of feeding the world appear just as it is, clearly out of the reach of biotech industry. Scientists propose instead that these large food corporations are actually more the cause of world hunger concurrently than they are the solution to it. It is on account of increasing corporate monopoly operating under the globalized economy that the poor are getting poorer and hungrier, scientists say. Finally, farmers around the world have been driven to destitution and suicide. Mergers and acquisitions are continued. Seed patent policies currently in place at biotech companies prevent farmers from saving and replanting seeds, an activity that scientists acknowledge is one enjoyed even by third world farmers. As promised, however, it only gets worse. Scientists agree that GMOs actually harm the delicate biodiversity necessary to the balance and maintenance of life on this planet. GM products, they say, decimate wild plant species indiscriminately, cause birth defects in mammals, kill insects essential to pollination like bees, lacewings, monarch butterflies, and pose other very serious threats related to horizontal gene transfer. For example, the spread of antibiotic-resistant marker genes that would render infectious disease untreatable. The generation of new viruses and bacteria that cause diseases and harmful mutations which may lead to cancer. Scary.
Oh, yeah.
Multiple hazards to both animal and human health have already been identified by sources around the world, resulting in either bans on GMO products or the adoption of strict labeling laws by many countries. Here in the U.S., however, secret memoranda from inside the FDA have revealed its history of disregarding the warnings of its own scientists. Still with a separate but similar mass appeal to the United Nations, an agricultural organization in 2009, failing to make a rippled, lasting impact, one can only hope that eventually the science of GMOs and the growing number of people who know about it will simply be too loud to ignore. Very, very scary stuff.
Let's do one more here. And
okay, that was from Wake Up Call, and that was by... Let me say who it was by. Okay. That was pretty scary. Oh, holiday lunacy. How Americans are conditioned to buy like Pavlov's dog when the corporate bell rings. This is an interesting article. So true. This is by Jacqueline Marcus for Buzzflash at Truth Out. Holiday lunacy. How Americans are conditioned to buy like Pavlov dogs when the corporate bell rings. The percentage you're paying is too high priced while you're living beyond all your means, and the man in the suit has just bought a new car from the profits he's made on your dreams. Traffic. Low spark of high heel boys. That's what that's from. Yes, it's the time of year again when working Americans foolishly blow their hard-earned money on junk, primarily because of the thousands of advertisements that tell them to do just that at an accelerated rate during the holidays. Of course, you're not supposed to know about the mothers and children in miserable conditions that labor to make all that material stuff for a buck a day, much less think about how the company men exploit the poor by turning them into robots. Just buy the stuff. That's all that matters. If you don't, shame, shame. Oh, the power of guilt. Why do you suppose the corporate networks broadcast the shopping malls as if it were a competitive race almost every right night, right till the end of New Year's? Oblivious shoppers, let me tell you a thing or two. There are no glossy photos at Gap, Old Navy, Tommy, Hilfiger, Macy's, or Kohl's that capture the slaves of the world, the mothers and fathers, the children in Pakistan, China, Afghanistan, Indonesia, Thailand, Mexico, around the globe, and yes, right here in the good old USA, sweating over hundreds of sewing machines for 10 hours at a time, shoulder to shoulder in suffocating, smelly rooms that resemble prisons with no fire exits. And when there are fires and workers die, the retailers simply turn their backs, refusing aid and compensation. When you see instead a beautiful, what you see instead are beautiful fashion models posing in a pair of tight jeans, or unbuttoned shirts, or girls in slick black dresses selling the illusion of sex appeal. The end result is that Americans end up in debt to their necks, while the high-heeled boys go merrily off to play from the profits they've made on your dreams. I don't know about you, but I dread this time of year when we're bombarded by the commercial world to buy, buy, buy. The bells, the whistles, the jingles, the flashing lights, the advertised sales that lunatics literally kill for as they blast through the doors of Walmart or Target, luring the masses in a fit of madness to fill up their enormous carts with tons of plastic garbage and polluting junk, even if they're still paying off their credit cards from last year's Christmas. And the winners are, as Senator Bernie Sanders pointed out, the Walton family of Walmart now owns more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans. Meanwhile, we continue to have by far the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. If I could announce a jolly holiday message over Walmart's intercom, it would sound something like this. Hello, Walmart shoppers. Would you please put the crap back where you found it and get a life? Thank you. Have a nice day.
So,
why are Americans the suckers, do you think?
We're big suckers. That's what we are. You know, we're born to be suckers. And you know who the biggest sucker in the whole sucker world is? It's Obama, okay? You know, Obama faces backlash over new corporate powers in secret trade deal. And, you know, I posted a post last week, I think it was, on his toilet paper policy, his Trans-Pacific policy. You know, and it shows what kind of a schmuck he is. He's trying to pull this deal secretly, okay, to give corporations unlimited freaking power, right? And over the trade deals, and give up our complete sovereignty, right? The Obama administration appears to have no international support for controversial new trade standards that would grant radical new political powers to corporations, increase the cost of prescription medications, and restrict bank regulations, according to two internal memos obtained by Huffington Post.
Mm-hmm.
The memos, which come from a government involved in the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Negotiations, detailed continued disputes in the talks over the deal. The documents reveal broad disagreement over a host of key positions and general skepticism that an agreement can be reached by year-end. And the Obama administration has urged countries to reach a deal by New Year's Day, though there is no technical deadline. One memo, which was heavily redacted before being provided to HuffPost, was written ahead of a new round of talks in Singapore this week. Read the full text of the HuffPost received here. But ellipses indicate redacted text, blah, 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 blah. But anyway, the Obama administration has been leading negotiations on the International Trade Accord since 2010. And the countries involved in the talks illustrate Australia, Brunei, Chile, Canada, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. One of the most controversial provisions in the talks includes new corporate empowerment language insisted upon by the U.S. government, which would allow foreign companies to challenge laws or regulations in a privately run international court. Under World Trade Organization treaties, this political power to contest government law is reserved for sovereign nations. The U.S. has endorsed some corporate political powers in prior trade agreements, and including the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, okay? But the scope of what laws can be challenged appears to be much broader in the TPP negotiations.
The United States, as in previous rounds, has shown no flexibility on its proposal, being one of the most significant barriers to closing the chapter, since under the concept of investment agreement, nearly all significant contracts that can be made between a state and a foreign investor are included. The memo reads, only the U.S. and Japan support the proposal. Under NAFTA, companies including Exxon, Mobil, Dow Chemical, and Eli Lilly have attempted to overrule the Canadian regulations on offshore oil drilling, fracking, pesticides, drug patents, and other issues. Companies could challenge an even broader array of rules under the TPP language. Instead of just having a fascist country like we are, we're striving for a fascist world. New standards concerning...
It's all part of the one world order.
Yeah, it'll be a fascist world. It'll be run by corporations.
Well,
it'll be a world run by Exxon, Mobil, Dow Chemical, Eli Lilly and the banks. What a mess.
All the pharmaceutical companies, all the oil companies, and, we're dead. Virtually dead. And this asshole Obama, okay, is the guy who's pushing it. Okay, he's pushing this. So, you know, why? And I'll tell you why. The reason why is because he's made all his deals with the corporations, and they're cramming it through in his election because they know damn well they'll never get it through any other way. All right? So it's pay the piper time. Right.
New standards concerning access to key medicines appear to be equally problematic for many nations. The Obama administration is insisting on mandating new intellectual property rules in the treaty that would grant pharmaceutical companies long-term monopolies on new medications. As a result, companies can charge high prices without regard to competition from generic providers. The result, public health experts have warned, would be higher prices around the world, lack of access to life-saving drugs in poor countries. Nearly every intellectual property issue in the November chart is opposed by a broad majority of the 12 nations. The December memo describes 119 outstanding issues that remain unresolved between nations on intellectual property matters. The deal would obligate nations to develop many standards similar to those in the U.S., where domestic prescription drug prices are much higher than costs in other nations.
Yeah, the U.S. is also facing major resistance on bank regulation standards. The Obama administration is seeking to curtail the use of capital controls by foreign governments. These can include an extremely broad variety of financial tools, from restricting lending in overheated markets to denying mass international outflows of currency during the financial panic. The loss of these tools will dramatically limit the ability of the governments to prevent and stem banking crisis. Mm-hmm. And the positions are still paralyzed. The December memo reads, referring to the financial chapter, a service chapter, the United States shows zero flexibility. Right? But previously leaked TPP documents have sparked alarm among global health experts, internet freedom activists, environmentalists, and organized labor, but are adamantly supported by American corporations and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Of course they are. And the Obama administration has deemed negotiations to be classified information, banning members of Congress from discussing the American negotiating position with the press or the public. What the hell? And congressional staffers have been restricted from viewing the documents, says the husband. I mean, this is like the ultimate criminal act. Yeah, this guy's a freaking traitor, you know, and he's our damn president. God damn.
Smiling. running over to say kind words
about
Nelson Mandela.
My buddy, my good friend Mandela, I love you so, you son of a bitch.
The guy would have, Mandela would have blown him up.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like him capitalizing on Martin Luther King.
Oh, that was horrible.
Martin Luther King would have hated this son of a bitch.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I just would have hated him. So, you know, it's like, you know, it's unbelievable. And he, you know, he just, I can't stand this man. I mean, under any circumstances, I can't stand this guy, you know. Here, Seymour Hersh says today that Obama lied.
Which time?
Well, what time? He definitely lied on Syria.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Says Pulitzer Prize winner is a journalist who famously exposed the My Lai massacre and the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, has levied a bombshell allegation against President Obama. Writing for the London Review of Books, Seymour Hersh alleged that President Obama had cherry-picked intelligence reports and deliberately misled the American people in the attempt to garner support for military operations in Syria this past summer. And Hersh reported that military and intelligence officials had confirmed to him that a deliberate manipulation of intelligence had taken place in order to lay the blame for sarin gas attacks on President Bashar al-Assad and his regime. He also alleged that Obama administration proposed purposely buried intelligence relating to Syrian rebel groups and their involvement with sarin gas. And Hersh says that the media and others engaged in the confirmation bias, seizing upon an uncertain UN report which linked the munitions used to deliver the deadly gas to those which are possessed by Assad's regime. However, MIT professor Theodore Postol and other experts later reviewed photos and determined that the delivery vehicle was likely a local-made improvised device pointing to the rebels as the culprit. President Putin and Assad ally Vladimir, Russian president, and Assad's ally Vladimir Putin has maintained that Syrian rebels had access to the sarin. He told his G8 that Russia had had evidence that the sarin gas was produced by Sunni in Iraq. We know that opposition fighters are detained on Turkish territory with chemical weapons, Putin said. We have information out of Iraq that a laboratory was discovered there for the production of chemical weapons by the opposition. In this open letter to the American people, Putin asked why Assad would gas his own people and risk raising the ire of the international community. Well, Hersh's allegations are serious and confirm the suspicion of the administration critics who feel the rush to war in Syria last summer was the agenda-driven and did not concern American security interests. This claim that the administration presented information that had cherry-picked to lure the American people into another war in the Middle East are quite serious and purposefully misleading the American people into military conflict is certainly a dereliction of duty from our commander-in-chief and yet another impeachable offense. The libertarian public has already documented the case for impeaching Barack Obama in a two-part feature on crime, foreign and domestic. The push for war in Syria and the arming of the Syrian rebels in violation of international law is covered in the first part. Hersh's allegations, however, add even more validity to these charges, and it paints a picture of an administration determined to involve U.S. troops in another needless war at any cost.
What? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it says for another needless war at any cost. It must be a
war?
Needless war.
They left out a word.
Say that. Well, in another needless war at any cost, and they put four. even directly lying to the American people. All right? So they need an editor on that one. But, hey, you know, that's what he's doing. That's what he's been doing. We knew it. We knew it. We knew it. You can get this at the Libertarian Republic. But, you know, man, I'll tell you, God just makes you sick.
Yeah, he smiles and, you know, just makes you such a hypocrite.
Oh, did you know that THC, which is the special drug that's in the marijuana, slows the progression of Alzheimer's disease?
Well, that's good to know.
Isn't that interesting? And also, did you know that alcohol was the leading gateway drug and not marijuana.
I thought that was kind of interesting.
That's right. Isn't that interesting, folks?
They tried to give marijuana a bad rap when it's really just a medication.
Marijuana is probably the greatest drug ever. Now, just to bring you up to date, what are the top 10 Roy Orbison songs?
Well, why would I know or care?
Well, I don't know. I just happened to wonder.
Well, what I wanted to talk about is 37 reasons why the economic recovery of 2013 is a giant lie.
Okay. But just before you do that, I'm just going to say there's 10 great, great Roy Orbison songs. And one of them is the first one. Number one is Pretty Woman. Number two is Crying. Number three is Domino. Number four is Running Scared. Number five is In Dreams. Number six is It's Over. Number seven is Only the Lonely. And number eight is Ooby Dooby. Okay, number nine is You Got It. And number 10, which is one I never heard of, Southbound Jericho Parkway.
Okay.
What do you think of that? Now, anyway, I like Roy Orbison, and I'm a fan of his. He's been dead for quite a while, but I was not a fan of his. So anyway, good. Somebody said, Roy Orbison, thank you. Send that to me today on my Facebook.
Activist post. 37 reasons why the economic recovery of 2013 is a giant lie. I'll just read a few. The only reason that the official unemployment rate has been declining over the past couple of years is the federal government has been pretending that millions upon millions of unemployed Americans no longer want a job and have left the labor force. Number two, the percentage of Americans that are actually working is much lower than it used to be. In November 2000, 64.3% of all working-age Americans had a job. When Barack Obama first entered the White House, it was 60.6% of all working-age Americans had a job. Now, today, only 58.6% of all working-age Americans have a job. How about that? Number three, the employment population ratio has now been under 59% for 51 months in a row. There are 1,148,000 fewer Americans working today than there were in November 2006. Meanwhile, our population has grown by more than 16 million people in that time frame. The inactivity rate for men in their prime working years, 25 to 54, has just hit a brand new all-time record high. Does that look like an economic recovery to you? The number of working-age Americans without a job has increased by a total of 27 million since the year 2000. In November 2007, there were 121.9 million full-time workers in the U.S. Today, there are only 116.9 million full-time workers in the U.S. Middle wage jobs accounted for 60% of the jobs lost during the last recession, but they have accounted for only 22% of the jobs created since then. Only about 47% of all adults in America have a full-time job at this point. The ratio of wages to corporate profits in the United States just hit a brand new all-time low. It's hard to believe, but in America today, one out of every 10 jobs is now filled by a temporary agency. Approximately one out of every four part-time workers in America is living below the poverty line. In this economic environment, there is an intense competition even for the lowest-paying jobs. Walmart recently opened up two new stores in Washington, D.C., and more than 23,000 people applied for just 600 positions.
Amazing.
That means that only 2.6% of the applicants were ultimately hired. In comparison, Harvard offers admission to 6.1% of their applicants. That's amazing. According to the Social Security Administration, 40% of all U.S. workers make less than $20,000 a year.
Okay.
40%. When Barack Obama took office, the average duration of unemployment in this country was 19.8 weeks. Today it's 37.2 weeks. According to the New York Times, long-term unemployment in America is up by 213% since 2007. Thanks to the Obama administration policies, which are systematically killing off small businesses in the U.S., the percentage of self-employed Americans is at an all-time low today. According to economist Tim Kaine, the following is how the number of startup jobs per 1,000 American breaks down by the presidential administration.
Oh,
what's the matter?
I'm having problems. I'm having problems getting onto this site.
Okay.
Okay. I lost my site.
Bush Senior. 11.3. Clinton. This is startup jobs. It just shows the steady decline. 11.3 Bush Senior, 11.2 Clinton, 10.8 Bush Junior, and Obama 7.8 per thousand. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, median household income in the United States has fallen for 5 years in a row. The rate of home ownership in the United States has fallen for 8 years in a row. Back in 1999, 64.1% of all Americans were covered by unemployment-based health insurance. Today, only 54.9% of all Americans are covered by unemployment-based health insurance. Thanks to Obamacare, millions more Americans are now losing their health insurance plans. As 2003 began, the average price of a gallon of regular gas was about $1.30 a gallon. When Barack Obama took office, when Barack Obama took office, the average price of a gallon of gas was $1.85. Today, it's $3.26. He's done a great job, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Total consumer credit has risen by a whopping 22% over the past 3 years. In 2008, the total amount of student loan debt in this country was sitting at about $440 billion. Today, it has shot up to approximately $1 trillion. Under Barack Obama, the velocity of money, and that's a very important indicator of economic health, has plunged to a post-World War II low. Back in the year 2000, our trade deficit with China was $83 billion. In 2008, our trade deficit with China was $268 billion. Last year, it was $315 billion. That was the largest trade deficit that one nation has had with another in world history. The gap between the rich and the poor in the United States is at an all-time record high. What's the problem?
I can't get on.
Get on what?
The blog talk.
Oh.
It cut out on me.
Well, then I'll go on in here. Why?
Because I need you there, Lila, so keep reading until I can get on this.
We'll do that.
If we don't, no, just keep reading, please. Thank you.
Right now, the 1.2 million students that attend public schools in the United States are homeless. This is a brand new all-time record high, and that number has risen by 72% since the start of the last recession. When Barack Obama first entered the White House, there were about 32 million Americans on food stamps. Today, there are more than 47 million. Right now, approximately one out of every five households in the U.S. is on food stamps. According to the Survey of Income and Program Participation conducted by the U.S. Census, well over 100 million Americans are enrolled in at least one welfare program run by the federal government. In 2000, the U.S. government spent $199 billion on Medicaid. In 2008, the U.S. government spent $338 billion on Medicaid. In 2012, the U.S. government spent $417 billion on Medicaid, And now Obamacare is going to add tens of millions more Americans to the Medicaid rolls. In 2000, the U.S. government spent $219 billion on Medicaid. In 2008, the U.S. government spent $462 billion on Medicaid. In 2012, the U.S. government spent $560 billion on Medicaid, and that number is expected to absolutely skyrocket in the years ahead.
Hello.
Hi, is this, hi, Julie?
Hi.
Hi, Julie.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm good.
I'm so sorry we got a little delay. We had a technical problem with our computer.
No, no problem. No problem.
But Julie Fisher is our guest tonight. We've introduced her earlier, but she wrote a book called Importing Democracy. And Julie, I want to introduce you to my co-host Delilah. And
hi, Julie. I'm pleased to meet you.
I'm glad to meet you as well.
We spoke earlier today, but I wanted to ask you, I guess, of all the things that we've talked about or over the many, many years about foreign interventions, okay?
Yeah.
I guess, you know, from your standpoint as a scholar and having, worked in this area all your life, what do you feel is the primary reason? What is the great benefit of going into countries and upsetting pushing our philosophies on them, you know?
Well, I think it's not even so much our philosophy as thinking that we know the answers for them. In other words, it's broader than simply pushing our philosophy.
Right.
In some ways, they might adopt some of our democratic ideas if they discover them for themselves. But when we go and we say, here's what you need to do, we know better, that's when we get into trouble. And I don't mean by this just official aid agencies or even, you know, in the worst case scenario, military interventions. I'm also talking about international NGOs. Let me make some initial, if I could, definitions of NGOs, different types. May I do that now?
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, NGO stands for non-governmental organization, and it's really just a way of dividing society into government organizations and for-profit organizations and nonprofits, which are often called non-governmental organizations in many countries. And in addition, it's important to make a distinction between international NGOs. We talked earlier today about Human Rights Watch being an international NGO, Amnesty International, Save the Children, CARE. They work on democracy. They work on development. And what I have written about in all three of my books, which are indigenous NGOs, NGOs created and organized by people in their own countries. There are a lot of partnerships, of course, between international and national NGOs, and we can get into that more, but I thought it was important at the beginning to, you know, give people some idea of the definitions, what we're talking about.
Tell us why you decided to pick this topic for a book.
Well, I was frustrated by the idea that you could try to export democracy militarily. That was the first thing, and we know what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. It didn't work very well. And then I began reading people like Amartya Sen, a scholar who writes about indigenous democratic traditions, which are already there. And I thought, why are we trying to export our particular idea of democracy when there's already a lot out there? And even people who try to export democracy peacefully have some of this problem, some of this mentality of we know best. It is a sort of heritage of, it's a sort of heritage from colonialism, if you will, that somehow we in the West, in the developed world, have the answers. And, you know, in many ways we don't. We might learn a lot from some other countries, in fact.
And you focus in your book on primarily three countries, Argentina, and South Africa and Tajikistan. Why did you choose those three?
Well, I worked as a program officer for the Kettering Foundation, which is a think tank on democracy, for 10 years. And I got to know people from a lot of countries. And I was about 40 or 50 countries. But I picked those three of the ones that I had gotten to know, of the people I'd gotten to know, because I wanted three different continents. I didn't want to write a book comparing this phenomenon of what I call democratization NGOs in, say, Argentina and Uruguay, because it wouldn't mean very much. So I wanted to do a Latin American country, and the Argentines seem to be extremely active in this field, all kinds of ways. The NGOs there have been promoting democracy or strengthening democracy. And I wanted an African country, and again, the same thing would apply to the people I met from South Africa. And Tajikistan was a country that the Kettering Foundation had been very active with since the 1990s, when they helped, before I was at the foundation, they brokered an end to the civil war by using civil society or NGOs first, and then developing a settlement over 3 years for the civil war, which the United Nations was able to literally almost copy and paste into the final peace settlement, which was much faster as a result of all the preliminary work that had been done.
Many of the
people who worked on those peace settlements in the 90s in Tajikistan then organized democratization NGOs they had the knowledge then to do that.
I was wondering, for instance, in South America, where you have, you've got the United States, at war with Argentina. Well, not Argentina, but, we've supported dictatorships throughout South America, throughout the world, actually. And the Perón, who is it? Everybody love Evita? At least they love the musical.
Actually, the U.S. wasn't too keen on Perón for a number of reasons, but in general, you're right that the U.S. traditionally supported dictatorships. And even the latest terrible dictatorship in Argentina between 1978 and 1982, the military junta, was supported, by the administration, by the U.S. administration.
Wasn't Evita Perón?
She was earlier. Perón, and one of the problems with Argentine politics is that people tend to be either pro-Peronist, they remember the Peronist days and they tend to be pro-Perón, or they tend to be anti-Peronist, Peronista. And it kind of distorts politics, but that's a separate issue. We can get into that if you want.
But
I think what's important now in Argentina are organizations like the Civil Asociación de Derechos Civiles, Civil Rights Association, which, for example, lobbied successfully to get Supreme Court nominees public hearings so that they no longer could, nominate a Supreme Court justice sort of behind the scenes. I mean, there have been some really amazing accomplishments by NGOs in Argentina in recent years.
Yeah, no, I can see that. But I think what bothers me so much is that for so many years, even to this day, under Obama, but the Bush administrations and Reagan administrations were so pro dictator down there, and then Negro Ponte had all of the secret killings there. He had they killed over 100,000 over 100,000 South Americans. It was Nicaragua. Nicaragua?
Well, I don't have all the data in front of me, but the junta itself in Argentina, killed 30,000 people in between 78 and 82. I don't have the data for Nicaragua or any of the other countries, but there's no question that our administration was, supporting dictatorships at that time, the Reagan administration. I don't think that's been as true since. I mean, Jimmy Carter, for example, really changed the policy and spoke out for democracy in many cases.
Yeah, but then Reagan,
it depends a little bit.
Reagan changed it all around again with Negroponte, didn't he?
Reagan went back to the more traditional policy then after that. But I don't think you could say that that's true today to nearly the extent. I mean, the problem today is not so much that the U.S. is, you know, supporting dictators. It's that we have an idea of democracy that's too narrow, that we think that elections by themselves create democracy. They don't. That's only one component of democracy.
The amazing thing to me was, okay, after the 2000 election in the United States, Jimmy Carter was asked by the press if he would an interview, if he would be willing to monitor the U.S. election, presidential elections, and he laughed out loud and he said that would he says no, he says it's totally our election process is totally unverifiable, you know.
Right.
He says, it's a joke amongst around the whole world, right? And but. You know, that in itself is what we are as a country. I mean, we aren't a democracy here anymore. We're a fascist country.
I guess I wouldn't agree with you. I don't really want to talk that much about the U.S. because it's not my field. I'm a political scientist, but I do not study U.S. politics. I have deep concerns about what's been happening, the polarization in U.S. politics. And a lot of other things, but I think I'd rather talk about the countries that I've studied, if we could.
Right, but I mean, I can understand that, and I we'll go back to that. But it's just to me that the principles that we are as a democracy, in quotes, are trying to present to the world, okay, is just we're just a major laughingstock because all of our interests are corporate interests. All right, oil, gas, plunder.
And there are conflicts. There are lots of conflicts between what we say and the vested economic interests. I agree with you there. All I'm saying is that I think there are a lot of problems with not just Americans but also Europeans.
Oh, they have their particular interests too.
If I could just finish, I think the problem that I see is with a lot of very good people who want things to get better, who want democracy, who want development, and do it in the wrong way. In other words, who think they know how to do it. And the last chapter of my book is devoted to a 12-step program for international donors so that they begin to listen and learn and do their homework about the countries they're working in before they jump in and decide what they're going to do. If they're going to support local NGOs, for example, they really have to do homework to find out who's doing what and where and how good they are. NGOs, some NGOs are excellent, and some are sloppy, or some are even corrupt. So it really requires a lot of on-the-ground, thoughtful interactions and study with local, local scholars who really know their own terrain. And most international donors don't do that. I'm not talking now about, foreign policy so much as about, USAID, but also unofficial donors, international NGOs.
You have guys like Soros, for instance.
Right.
Who are notorious for setting up their NGOs, going in and totally
destabilizing
the country.
I guess having seen what they have done in Tajikistan, at least there, I would have to disagree with you, because one of the things they've done there is to support in a very creative and low-key and not a lot of money way an amazing organization of women lawyers in Tajikistan who've made some major changes in the legal system to benefit women. So I could only say that, from my on-the-ground observations of Soros, at least in Tajikistan, and I don't want to speak about other countries, I think they've done an excellent job there. I happen to know what their support has accomplished. I think you have to be a little careful, because sometimes when you read accounts about a group like Open Society, for example, you get people who write these things sometimes have their own vested interests, and they make very big sweeping generalizations that you have to be a little careful about. I can also tell you that Soros in South Africa has done a lot of good things as well. I interviewed people who knew about their work there.
Yeah, something that captured the imagination of most people was the Arab Spring. And
yeah.
It seems to have collapsed, and particularly
right.
in Egypt. And what do you know about that? Why do you think that collapsed? What happened there?
Well, I wrote my first book in 1993 about development NGOs in the Third World. And I made a fairly large generalization, which was that most of them were autonomous from their own governments. In other words, they were independent. They didn't get money from their governments. And that made them better and stronger organizations. But there was one country that was an exception to my generalization, and it was Egypt. The Egyptian NGOs were already under, when Mubarak had just come in 20 years ago, well, he'd been in a few years, I guess, and they were taking money from the Egyptian government. And that meant that they didn't develop the kind of autonomy and strength that NGOs need in order to be contributors to a strong civil society. And so when the events in Egypt, you had people in the streets in Egypt, but they didn't have the strong institutional backing of an independent civil society. And so I wasn't, frankly, surprised by what happened in Egypt. I almost could have predicted it from what I wrote about 20 years ago. Egypt was so different from the rest of the Third World countries. In Libya, for example, there are some autonomous NGOs, and there are also, of course, armed militias. And so no one knows which is going to prevail, but there are Middle Eastern countries with civil societies that are independent, but Egypt was not one of them. So the protesters really stood alone, maybe with the Internet, but they didn't have the kind of support they needed from civil society.
Now, you know, I noticed this on your blog, for instance, you had an article called Democratization Triangle.
Yeah.
Protesters build ties with civil society. And here's a situation. I don't want to take it away from the others, but from your other areas. But I noticed, for instance, in Occupy Wall Street, there definitely was civil society was definitely involved with that. Okay,
a tiny part was involved with Occupy Wall Street. That was one of the.
Oh yeah, but it was so bludgeoned. Okay. And so immediately put down by these damn New York policemen and all these thugs,
right.
Right? I mean, it was just and then it was infiltrated. It was totally infiltrated.
Support with
everybody, the FBI, the CIA, and every other god-awful NSA, and everyone else was, you know, it was down there to the point where these guys didn't have a chance, even though they were there and they were working hard and they were building up a strong base and a strong support base. They were immediately crushed. I mean, they were crushed, by the loyal opposition, if you will. But
we don't have the kind of organization. We do have some, but they weren't connected to Occupy Wall Street. And I'm not saying it was one side's fault or the other. They just didn't build. They didn't have connections. They didn't have the kind of institutional connections that could have supported them. So the institutions that suppressed them were able to just go in and do that. There are several organizations now working, for example, to overturn the Supreme Court decision, the corporations are people decision, I call it. And those I would say those are sort of equivalent to the organizations I studied in the three countries that I focused on. There are a number of them trying to get a constitutional amendment to reverse that decision through state legislatures. And, you know, so there are organizations in this country that are working on strengthening democracy, on rolling back some of the really bad things that have happened recently. But I don't think they were connected to the Occupy Wall Street.
Okay, now I know.
And I'm not saying it's one the side of either the fault of either side. They just didn't have those kinds of connections. And that's one of the reasons I, you know, wrote about the democratization triangle, because I think you need you need those connections.
I agree with you on that, but I believe that there was that. But you know, when you have such a brutal oppression that you have there with Bloomberg, he's amazing. He's unbelievable. I mean, this guy's a dictator if there ever was one. Right.
Yeah, we had it here in Portland too, and it wasn't suppressed that way here.
Yeah,
and that's one of the problems with protests. You know, people get tired after a while. It's hard to live out on the street. It's hard to go on and on with it. And here in Portland, that's what happened. People just got tired and went home. They weren't,
they ran out of steam, huh?
Yeah.
They ran out of steam. Yeah, and that's why institutionalization is so important, because people, you know, who don't have that, they don't have any backing. And, you know, the other thing I write about in my book, which is the idea of loyal opposition. And one of the things that democratization NGOs do is to build up civil society in these countries so that it can become a kind of loyal opposition. Because in none of the three countries that I studied do you have a strong opposition party, which is loyal to the system but against the regime. They just they're small. The opposition parties are very small and splintered.
You know, in our great democracy, we don't have a third party either. You know, we don't have an opposition party because basically a Republican and Democrats are the same, you know.
I think it would make a farce of an opposition.
I wondered if I could just let people know, since we're getting close to the end, I wonder if I could just let people know how to get the book. Okay, you can go to my website, which is importingdemocracy.org. Make sure it's O-R-G. Some people try com, and that doesn't work. You can order it through the Kettering Foundation, which is kettering.org, or you can go on Amazon, or you can go to your independent bookstore, which I like to plug, and get them to order it.
I have one other question before we go, because I know you're connected to the Council on Foreign Relations and so on, and you've written for them. But what's your opinion of that organization as far as?
I've written a couple of blogs for them. You know, like any organization, I think they have a mixed group of people with many different opinions. I can only say that the people I've worked with are thoroughgoing professionals, good writers, interested in research.
Do you believe that?
I don't know about their political role. I haven't researched that. But I think Foreign Policy is a very lively magazine. I like Foreign Policy better than I like Foreign Affairs, the two that they produce. Foreign Policy is full of contrary views and interesting, provocative articles.
Okay. Well, anyway, I didn't mean to throw you off your game there, but I just wanted to broaden this a little bit further, because one of the greatest problems I think people are faced with today is trying to understand the role of these organizations. But one last question I have for you, and I should have probably opened it with it, was about, of course, Nelson Mandela and the importance,
right,
to Africa, South Africa. What do you make of his, do you think, aside from the great hoo-ha that we saw today, what do you think his legacy will be there?
Well, I just wrote a blog about this, and I talked about how he was a very rare political leader. We don't have many political leaders anywhere as great as he was. And partly it was that he was able to bring people together in an amazingly unique way. He learned that from 27 years in prison, that, as he said in his writings, I learned that treating a bitter, angry jailer as a human being might produce a blanket for the night. So he was a very pragmatic person. But I think there is something else about Mandela, that he had an impact on people, not just in South Africa, but everywhere, because he was able to bring out their own latent idealism, their own desire for change. And that was a source of huge strength, because that kind of almost reflected back on him as a leader, even when he was no longer president. I would just say that the 30 democratization NGOs that I interviewed in South Africa have a really unique tie with him, because he is a worldwide democratic hero, and there are very few of those in the world. It's hard to think about, you know, it's amazing how rare it is and sad. I think that's one of the things that democratization NGOs, even if they change a lot of things like the courts for the better, or they get people in villages participating politically, and there are many such stories in my book, a leader like that at the top doesn't just, it's pretty hard to sort of promote someone like that. It was a series of circumstances that produced him, and for them, he is a great asset for the democratization.
Do you think now that he's dead, do you see that his influence waning there or fading?
Well, we won't really
know.
It's hard to predict. I think the his South Africa. I mean, he was the father of his country in a real sense, because he brought people together who, I mean, the first time we took a flight in South Africa, we met a white farmer who said to us, "You will not meet a white person in South Africa today who doesn't get down on his knees every night and thank God for Nelson Mandela," because the white people thought that they were going to be massacred, because they knew how horrible it had been. At some gut level, they knew how terrible the situation had been. And they couldn't imagine that people who had been treated that way wouldn't be incredibly angry. And what was amazing is that Mandela channeled the end of apartheid into a more positive period. Now, having said that, there are a lot of issues that, you know, a lot of problems of inequality in South Africa, terrible unemployment,
And they never really had any kind of financial control. The Boers kept all the money. You know,
the what?
There are some blacks that have power, but let's face it, it's always, they're the face. The power is the money, and the money is still held.
Well, that's true everywhere, isn't it, to some degree. But, you know, in South Africa, I would say the people at the bottom have benefited somewhat. They have electricity now. They have clean water. They have more access to education than they did, but their unemployment problem is terrible, and they've got to do something to solve that. It's very difficult. You know, it's a funny society now, because you have black millionaires in South Africa now. You know, you see them at fancy restaurants. You have more mobility than you had, much more mobility, and it's not just based on race. On the other hand, you have a lot of poor people, including some poor white people.
Oh, yeah.
But are those black millionaires becoming millionaires by exploiting their own people?
Well, the ones that, I mean, I'm thinking of Cyril Ramaphosa, for example, who, no, I wouldn't say that that's true of him. He's just a brilliant guy who made a lot of money, and I don't know the details about his history, but he might be a future president, and, you know, that's a possibility.
Well, unfortunately, we've come right to the end of our show, and it was really fun talking to you.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
And I'd like to get your book and tell them one more time where they can get it.
Yeah, you can go to importingdemocracy.org, or you can go to kettering.org, which is the foundation that published it, the Kettering Foundation Press. Or you can go to Amazon.com and just put in Importing Democracy. That may be the easiest. Or get your bookseller to order it for you.
Well, great. And we thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
We've enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, we got it.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night. Good night. Fisher for that, and we will say good night. Join us tomorrow night when we talk communion issues and bring you more fascinating news and possibly an interview. So good night, everyone.
Good night, folks.
That's right. Yeah, that's what it's, but she, you know, she.
Well, she's a scholar.